I guarantee you when they find out what this is about, it's going to be about nothing. It's going to be about absolutely nothing. So the other, like, epidemic that we have to respond to is this sense of hopelessness of kids with guns that will kill other kids. They lost this bright, beautiful boy who should be doing what 11-year-olds are doing. That's what he should be doing. And because somebody senselessly shot up his neighborhood, he's dead. It's not a game, it's not a video, it's not coming back, it's real bullets kill children.
John Ayala is the founder of the DC Guardian Angels. He is also the grandfather of Devon McNeil, also Dr. Bahia Muhammad, associate professor in the Department of Criminology and Sociology with Howard University. Lines are open at 202-319-7810. You can certainly tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. John and Dr. Muhammad, thank you both for joining this conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And John, let me first extend my deepest condolences to you and your family in the loss of Devon. This is a horrific tragedy, and I realize that this is a very difficult time for you. And again, I really appreciate you coming on to talk to us about this. Have you heard anything from the police since the death of your grandson about any progress in the case? First things first here.
Okay. So right now I'm going to just say they're doing the best they can. It is under investigation. So, you know, you can't give out too much information, but they are working 24 hours around the clock to solve this as soon as they can.
Mm-hmm. You have been boots on the ground in D.C., in dealing with deadly violence, literally for decades. From your perspective, can you talk to me a little bit about what you believe is actually going on in the streets of D.C. compared to when you first started the D.C. Guardian Angels?
Well, you gotta remember, when I first started, it was just like this. It was back in the 80s and the early 90s when we had crack cocaine exploding around D.C. And we had to put boots on the ground in Potomac Gardens, Kentland Apartments, Trenton Park, Paradise, these places where it was out of control. Shootings were very murders were very high. I'm talking about over 500 murders a year. Now it went away, and that's because of the efforts that were going on, all the different, the different special police units that they had. They had so many different police units that were going out, and they were focused on certain issues. And with them, with those units focusing on certain issues, the crime rate started to drop. Now, it's different. All those units that we had, they're gone. And they're not just gone in D.C. They're gone in Chicago. They're gone in Detroit. They're gone in New York City. And with these units being gone, these young men or women, whoever they are, they feel that they can get away with what they're doing in our communities because are these special units not being there to go after them as they did once at one time before. Back in the 80s, we had a radio show. You might remember it, City Under Siege, Ron Garvin.
It's
going to get back to that. It looks like it's going that way again, that we're going to need show a City Under Siege because our city is definitely under siege at this time.
Mm. Dr. Muhammad, from your perspective, what do you believe is the root cause of the kind of violence that we are now seeing in D.C.? And the reason we wanted to have you on the program because you bring such a unique perspective to all of this. This is something that you've studied. This is your wheelhouse. And we're often, you know, we hearken back to that video that we saw just a few weeks ago in Northeast where teenagers were jumping out of cars and shooting in all kinds of directions, and they just seem so young. What's going on?
You know, it's a very traumatic time, you know, and I think one of the things that I was thinking about as I've been watching all of this uncover is this concept of post-traumatic slave syndrome and how we are dealing with a hurt population. We are dealing with individuals who are empowered by the holding of a weapon, by, you know, being able to senselessly shoot into any direction without even a clear sense of a target and being able to get away with it. I think that there is a sense of power that youth are given because there is this concept of being seen and not heard. And so there are painful hearts on every side of the equation. And we start to see this happen all across the nation when policies happen where they took away the after-school programs, when they took away, you know, all of the things and activities that individuals had in Black communities and took away their access to be powerful on a court and to be powerful in a game, where now this easy access to guns is a quick opportunity to enter a gang, a quick opportunity to show strength where no strength lies at all, and, you know, definitely an option to enter a society of delinquency that is enveloping individuals in where they're being pushed out of all of these pro-social environments.
You know, John, when we looked at the crack cocaine epidemic in the district during the 80s and the 90s, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's safe to say that with all of the blood that was running in the street at that time, that a lot of those murders were related to the drug trade. Dealers and their lieutenants marking territory, this was part of the bloody drug business. Are we seeing that same thing now, or is it different?
Well, of course it's not with the drugs at this time. It's more of community beef. The people want the same type of power. They want to control communities that they have no lease to, and they just want to be the head honcho in the community. So with these young people nowadays, they do not value life at all. And it's sad because we have people, organizations saying Black Lives Matter, and the first thing we're going to tell other people that Black Lives Matter, we have to matter to us first. And I think that I grew up with a single mother home, and I had a mother only, and my sisters. I didn't have a father living in the home, but for some reason I was able to see the light and go in the right direction. My mother did a good job. But I'm not saying the mothers out here now are not doing a good job. But the difference is when I was younger, I did something wrong. My mother scared me more than Jesus Christ can. She mm-hmm. would tear my behind up. The closest switch, the closest slipper, and those slippers had hard heels on it. You get hit in your lip will bust it. The kids of today don't get that. And I'm not saying we need to abuse our kids, but we just don't get that any longer. Was somebody saying something, sir?
No, I'm sorry. That's our producer. They need to cut the microphone in the studio off. But please go right ahead.
Okay. So that doesn't happen today. Right now, you know, if you even touch your kid, you can be brought up on charges. And I think they're not, the city doesn't, the government don't let us discipline our kids at a young age like we should discipline them. And I'm not saying abuse them, but they need better discipline. You can't tell us we can't discipline our kids, and then when our kids go out there and do something wrong, you want to sometimes lock the parents up. I think we got to go back to the disciplining days back when you do something wrong, your friends or your mother friends here, they're going to give you a little bit of a backhand, and then when you get to your back, get to your parents, the same thing is going to happen. But again, these kids, they're not afraid. They're not afraid to pick up guns. Guns are easy access to them, and they use it because it's powerful. They believe when they have that, nobody is going to mess with them. And they can walk around the streets with them. Why can't they? Because there's no more jump out units. There's no more, and you know, it was controversy. Nobody wants stop and frisk. But I think at this time, I hate to say it, but I believe we need it, you know, a stop and frisk, because these young people feel they can walk around and carry weapons and do what they want. We need more cops also stopping these cars with these tent windows. They got tent windows riding around. They don't stop these cars anymore. They used to stop them, but I see every day dark tent windows riding around. Guess what they have in those cars with them? Firearms.
We are talking about the spike of deadly gun violence in D.C. and in other big cities. My guests are John Ayala, founder of the D.C. Guardian Angels and grandfather of Devon McNeil, who was killed less than a week ago, and also Dr. Bahia Muhammad, associate professor in the Department of Criminology and Sociology with Howard University. Dr. Muhammad, talk to me about what John was just saying as it relates to attitudes and no fear, and it seems to me no empathy for life. Where is that coming from?
I mean, if you think about it, you know, they got rid of the codes of the street. You know, when you look at mass incarceration and the sheer numbers of black brothers who are locked up behind these bars, who grandfathers, they have geriatric units of individuals. So you're telling me you're taking a father away, you're taking a grandfather away. Where are the codes of the street? When do we get back to respect, you know, to dignity, to integrity, to the things that the wise individuals give down generation and generation? You're talking about young folk that's out here, you know, they have no respect for themselves. How do you respect another life when you don't even respect yourself? There's self-hate. You hate your black skin, you know, that you in. So that weapon, that ability to pick something up that allows you to be seen, allows you to be heard, allows you to get girls, allows you to get money and take whatever you want, you don't even know your history. You don't even know where you're coming from. These are lost souls. These are individuals that don't fear God. So therefore, they're not fearing anybody else. Their actions, nobody is holding individuals accountable. There were people out there. There should not be a mayor that has to come out and say, this is the amount that we have to give. The community should have stepped up, because that is a breach of the contract that we know that the codes of our street don't run on. This is unapproved, it's unrecognized, it's disrespectful, it's unsafe, it's conflicted, it's confused, and that it leads to this sense of shame. And so therefore, I think a lot of young individuals are turning to where they could get that support, you know? And on the other end of things, you know, this is one of the things, a child, a lost life of all of these children that we all agree on. This is enough. This is enough.
Talk to me a little bit, Dr. Muhammad. Also, you know, the mayor and the police chief keep talking about the availability of guns, and that is one of the major problems. I'll let you answer it on this side, and then I'm going to take a break, and I'll have John pick it up. But do you think that that is the issue, availability of firearms?
Absolutely, that is the issue. You know, when I think about these different communities that have money, and when you think about the statistics, you know, there are larger percentages of white men that are dying from suicide, the use of suicide with guns, than homicide. We don't have those statistics that are out there on the front line, and those are the same individuals that don't want to address this access to guns. But when you go into these communities that have high socioeconomic status, they have, you know, days, you know, shooting camps where they're able to go and shoot at targets, and it's a game and it's a skill. Where here you're talking about they've taken everything, you know, away from individuals to be able to even learn or to be able to engage. This is definitely a political argument as well, and definitely, you know, the access to guns is something, because how did all of the illegal guns get in our communities in the first place.
Mm. That's fascinating. I need to take a break, but I want to let our listeners know that we are going to continue this conversation on Sirius XM channel 141 in just a bit. And by the way, you can hear this in every discussion of the Insight segment via podcast on WHUR.com. It's posted on our website before 9 p.m. every single night. So please stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. The original Quiet Storm on WHUR is next. This conversation continues on Sirius XM in just a few seconds. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we are talking about the spike of deadly gun violence in D.C. and in other big cities. My guests are John Ayala, founder of the D.C. Guardian Angels. He is also the grandfather of Devon McNeil, who tragically lost his life. He was caught in the crossfire of gun battle in D.C. during the 4th of July weekend. Also, Dr. Bahia Muhammad, she is associate professor in the Department of Criminology and Sociology here at Howard University. At the risk of talking about the old days, John, and this gun situation, when I was growing up, just outside of D.C. in Prince George's County, the whole issue about guns, whether we knew where they were or not, was that we were afraid of them, and that we were taught they were dangerous, stay away from them, so forth and on. And even in the scuffles that we may have had on the block, before school, after school, in school, what have you, even if you want to fight and you hurt somebody, you felt bad about it because you hurt another human being. First thing, your thoughts about the access of guns, and secondly, are these young people desensitized about hurting other human beings?
Okay. So first, the weapons, these guns that are coming into D.C., we do not have any gun stores in Washington, D.C. The stores that are in Virginia and they are in Maryland. The guns that are being used are not legal guns. They're not coming from the stores. They're coming from the streets. And I still truly believe that these guns are coming out of Virginia, coming down from New York, whole bunch of different places. Another thing that they have now, and I'm quite sure you heard of it, is ghost guns, where you can get these guns and they have no serial number on it. And people found ways of getting these guns, and they are all over the streets of D.C. So they're very easy to get to. If you live in what we call the hood and you want a gun, you could just go ask somebody and they'll be able to get the gun to you. And it shouldn't be that easy. People that have these guns, they don't value life. And I don't want to put it too much on video games or TV shows, but some of these guys do honor shows like that. You see bad guys with the guns. The video games they want to play are video games where you are shooting police officers, robbing people. You remember Grand Theft Auto? It was a big thing when Grand Theft Auto came out. And the young people like that, and then they come out and they start getting their hands on rail guns, and they think this is a video game. But they don't realize that it's not a video game because you don't turn it off and come back. And, it's a video game. You can turn it off, turn it back on, and people are there. If it's a movie or TV show, somebody get killed in one show, they come back in another show. In real life, it doesn't happen. Once a person is dead, they're dead. And these young people want to get other young people to fear them. So when they have a gun in their hand, they feel very powerful. And if other people know that they will, put a body on, get a body other young people are not going to want to deal with them because they know in the streets they are tough guys. So they want to be known as a tough guy, and they want to be the king of their area, and this is why they're going out and taking lives. They really just don't value life at this time.
You know, you said something earlier that struck me as it relates to how someone may appear in their own community, not so much turf wars, but what seems to be happening now is that there are perceived slights, perceived issues of disrespect that often lead to, as you say, community beefs. Can you talk to me a little bit about what that means for someone who's on the outside looking in and trying to figure out how a perceived beef, quote unquote, can lead to, you know, a deadly incident?
Okay. So, yeah, in the black community, if you felt disrespected in any kind of way, and it's not all of us now, of course. I'm in the black community. I am a black man, okay? But in the black community, people don't want to be disrespected. It's, again, they want to be the man. So if you disrespect me in a way where you might have said something to me that was offensive in front of my friends or another young lady, I'm going to come back, and I'm not saying me personally, of course, mm-hmm. but want to come back and settle that beef with a firearm, you know, because they don't value. When we got disrespected, like you said, when we was younger, and we probably got mad, walked off, talked about it, and the next day we were friends again. But here, people don't want to do that. They feel, I have to end this beef by letting them know you're not going to disrespect me like that. And I think it's just a mentality also with young people, because they have so many brothers, fathers, and cousins that are incarcerated. And they feel that if they become incarcerated, they're going to be okay. They got friends in there. Their brother did 5 years. I could do 5 years. If I go in jail, I'm going to really be the man. So it doesn't bother them at all to be incarcerated. But with the beef, if you can do anything to be disrespected, feel disrespected, and they'll come back and to finish that disrespect, they're going to murder somebody.
Mm. Talk to me a little bit, Dr. Muhammad, about the psychology behind that. You know, you spoke earlier about, you know, kind of the historic relationship between black people and disrespect by white people. Is that now some kind of perversion that has carried over into the black community with young people?
Absolutely. I mean, we can't forget about our roots. That doesn't go anywhere. When you talk about, you know, redlining, when you talk about, you know, gentrification, when you talk about not giving individuals access to, you know, outside communities and options to see other things, they're limited to those around them. And we know in all communities where individuals are around themselves, those are typically the individuals that they go to. But specifically around this concept of respect, which I think, you know, it generated itself, the sense of disrespect during enslavement, and we are the last of the Mohicans to yet receive reparations, but even acknowledgement of the pain and the disrespect. And when you think about the colonizers, the use of the gun was their power. That was the power that they had. And when we were disrespectful in the sense of speaking out of order, touching on our children, wanting to maintain our family, wanting to engage in communication, wanting to have faith, wanting to do all of the things that you see happening now in our youth, it is almost a mirror reflection of the colonizer. And now it's a part of our own community where this idea of the lack of respect is perceived by some African-American youth as compromising their identities, and it becomes a threat to their safety. So these groups that are subjected to trauma and oppression, these experiences produce feelings inside of them that is uncontrollable aggression, hypersensitivity regarding their own self-worth. I'm telling you, these brothers, they're not out there and engaging in no conversation like, oh, you did what was right. Like, you missed the target. You need to give yourself in. It is over for that. Like, at the end of the day, they need to turn themselves in. Forget about the money and individuals having. They need to come up and really be a man and gain the respect and turn themselves in. That was wrong, and there's no way around it when it comes to children, period. And we all know that. But definitely this idea of not being able to be a black man and cry, not knowing how to be a man because the men are disappearing in the community, this is by strategy. And that doesn't mean that it takes any sort of, you know, ownership or onus off of the individual. Wrong is wrong, period. But yes, there's a lot of what happened to us that continues to happen. If you find yourself in the 21st century still yelling and screaming that Black Lives Matter, these are individuals whose lives to themselves don't matter. They don't matter. And all they have at the end of the day is this sense of power and this sense of strength and wanting to, you know, I'm not afraid of this gun and I'm going to take somebody's life. But you don't know how to shoot a target. You don't know where you're shooting. You out here killing all of these little babies who are our next generation. That there's no strength in that. It is only weakness. And the only strength that comes from that is to turn yourself in. So if you are out there listening, they should turn themselves in.
Let's talk about the Black Lives Matter thing, because you are not just a boots-on-the-ground intellectual and one of the many prizes of Howard University, but you are also up to your neck in activism, okay? And as a result, you have heard people say, you know, if Black Lives Matter as it relates to police brutality against people of color, then what about what people are calling black-on-black crime? Shouldn't that also be a Black Lives Matter? But the argument is that is not an equal comparison. What say you?
I would say that individuals need to really look at, you know, the data. Similarity to, you know, the research, it has found that, yes, many young black men are, you know, most likely to be these perpetrators and victims of these gun homicides. But also what they have found is that they suffer from a similar condition of post-traumatic syndrome brought on by repeated exposure to violence, extreme poverty, high unemployment, drug and alcohol abuse, and other social ills that create a sense of hopelessness. Bring back activities into our communities. You know, what more does it take? Give individuals, younger individuals, things to do besides railroading them into a prison system where they are thinking, oh, this ain't nothing to me. You know, I could come back out, and this is not going to engage in, you know, any sort of way. Parents are, you know, fighting and running a rat race, not even having time at the end of the day to engage with the younger individuals in our community. Back in the day, I always had conversations with my grandmama and with my grandpa and with my father and with the uncles and men around the house. Were they out there doing the wrong thing? No, they were doing the right thing. And matter of fact, don't try to come and get no gun from nobody, because you're going to get bust upside of your head and you're going to get turned around. Where is the code of the street now with these brothers that are giving these younger brothers these guns, knowing they can't even read or write? You think they deserve to have that power when they don't even have social capital? Everybody is a part of this, and we all must be held accountable.
John, you wanted to make a comment?
Yeah, no, because you mentioned Black Lives Matter, and, you know, my thing is, Black Lives Matter, I understand the concept somewhat. They put together Black Lives Matter because they feel, look, we have to make sure that these officers that are hurting people in our black community are accountable for what they do. They feel that if we don't put pressure on them, these officers would not be placed under arrest and justice would not be served. And I understand that. But I also believe if you're going to yell Black Lives Matter, it should not only matter when an officer hurts a black person. It has to matter also when a black person hurts a black person, especially people like children. Now, it should not, that's not involved in any of the incidents. Older people, that's not involved. Some of these guys, they are going out there and they're shooting at one another. They're shooting back. And even when they shoot at each other, I still feel, you know, those lives matter as well. The reason why they're shooting at each other because they didn't have the guidance that they should have. They didn't have nobody to talk to. They're afraid when they know there's an issue, they're not going to report it to anyone because they believe in the street code as snitches get stitches. You know, and I think that that campaign has to be changed. We have to change our culture from snitching to reporting. And why you should report when you see a crime in your community. What happens now, when there's a crime, we turn our head, we pull down our blinds, we go put extra locks on our doors so it won't come in there, and we go buy a pit bull. We need to open up those shades, sit on our doorsteps, and let people know if you commit a crime in our community, we are going to report you. That's it. Because there's that campaign is made to scare people in the community. And when it scares people in the community, the criminals hurt other criminals, and I'm saying the black-on-black crime. And when that happens, the Black Lives Matter organizations, I don't see them in our community protesting a lot. Now, maybe it's something I have, maybe it's out there and I don't see it. But I've spoke to many people, and a lot of them are saying, why, when this young man is killed, why is this young lady is killed, we have not seen people come in there in an outrage like we saw 3 weeks ago.
But, John, let me ask you, because I think the argument is that with the Black Lives Matter movement, we are talking about adult police officers who are paid by the state / governmental agencies, who have training, who are trained to protect and serve, human beings though they may be. But these are adults. They are supposedly going through training so that they can protect and serve the community. Is that an equal comparison with teenagers, for example, who may not, as we said earlier in this conversation, may not have had the correct supervision, guidance, and mentoring, but have also been given access to guns, like the police officers, and no way to find an outlet for their anger if they feel disrespected or something like that? Is that the same thing?
I definitely believe it is, because the model is Black Lives Matter. And so if it's Black Lives Matter, it should not, depends on if it's a professional that's trained and young people that are not trained. It's supposed to be about people that are taking the lives of other black people, because their lives supposed to matter. So what we need is, when it's happened, is the organizations to also go in, talk to our local governments and say, look, we have a crisis in this community. We need to put some kind of aid here, because we have black people killing black people here. We have young people that are dying. We need to get people in here that are professionals, that can counsel people that are in this community. We have had organizations like Peaceaholics back in the day that some of them have done the crimes that they have done the crimes in the past, and they can go into the community and talk to these other young people and get that respect and get them to listen to them and can probably squash some of these beasts. But organizations like that, organizations like mine and some other organizations out there, don't get the funding to go in there. Now, if Black Lives Matter, you really don't need the funding. You go in there and do the best you can. But, you know, these people that start these organizations, they also, you know, need to make a living. But my thing is, if someone get killed in a Black community by another Black person, that lives matter too. I don't care what that person did wrong, because you know what? That person have a mother, a sister, a brother, and other loved ones. And they have people that care about them. So we got to go in there and learn how to counsel them before incidents happen. And when an incident occur, we need to go in after the incident and also counsel them.
Dr. Muhammad, let's talk a little bit about some possible solutions, new or innovative, progressive solutions for a problem that is many generations old. The horrific irony of the loss of Devon is not lost on any of us that, you know, his loving mother was a violence interrupter working in the community to prevent the kinds of things that happened to her son and that have been happening for years before this past weekend. What needs to happen from a community standpoint, from a governmental standpoint, in your opinion, to help relieve some of this deadly pressure that is on the necks of some of our communities?
Number one, the community needs to gain an understanding of the reality that, you know, long before the March for Our Lives and Black Lives Matter dominated the headlines in these recent years, African Americans were marching in crime-ridden neighborhoods to protest killings. You talk about in New York, specifically, you know, in Harlem, this is like 2012. You can look in Newark in 2009, in Pittsburgh in September of 2010, in Michigan. These are not the things that they propel or talk about. And Ta-Nehisi Coates talked about this back in 2012 in a piece that he wrote in The Atlantic, that, you know, ultimately the shame that we carry because of black-on-black crime is the reason why the media doesn't provide all of the movements around it. Because in communities, people were knocking on doors. And I think that that's the solution. We have to hold our streets accountable. We know where these individuals live. There were individuals that were out there. Yes, we say that talk is cheap. Yes, snitches get stitches. We understand that component. Man, you got to throw that out the ball game when we're talking about young children, when we're talking about our lives, when we're talking about all lives that matter. We have to get to a point where this must stop. And that means that the community, we have to hold each other accountable. We can no longer glamify and glorify individuals that's out here street hustlers. This is what I use to pay, you know, to take care of my children. There are other jobs, brother, because at the end of the day, we got to clean it up. We know the reality of what they created for us, but now we are walking into it ourselves. And Dr. DeGroy talks about it often in post-traumatic slave syndrome. You don't even need the MASA no more, because now you're just doing it. This is out of control. And individuals within, you know, 20, 30 minutes of this airing, whoever hears this, they need to step up and really be the true leaders of the community. Two, we need to fund these organizations. The Guardian, the Credible Messengers, you know, these individuals that we are saying they are no good. You know, there are people out there that have been incarcerated and they are coming home and telling these young jokers, you know, with still bullets inside of their bodies, this is not cool. You can't survive this sort of, you know, sort of philosophy. It is no longer a rite of passage. We need to change our language and we need to change our action and we need to address our youth. No longer can we sit around as adults and act like we're scared of these children. These are babies out here. Can't even keep their hands, you know, steady to even shoot at a target. Where you killing these, you know, senseless acts of young babies that we have to be on these calls engaging in the dialogue. This is unacceptable. We have to retake over the streets and define the codes of the streets. For our politicians, please, please understand, when we talk about the divestment of law enforcement, we are saying put the money where it needs to be. Our children need help. They are crying out, but this is a cry for help. It is unacceptable, but our babies are hurting to the point that they're hurting other babies. This is ridiculous, y'all. Like, this is beyond anything. Nobody's grandfather that started these organizations that are governing in peace should ever have to engage in this dialogue. This is disrespectful. We need to hold individuals accountable.
You know, John, and Dr. Muhammad is always passionate and always right. You know, that's why we love to have her, you know, on the program. You know, from your perspective, because the thing that she just talked about was hearts and minds. How do you change the hearts and minds of these young people? Or do we have to start with the parents before their parents about learning how to recondition their thoughts so that when they have children, young men, for example, you know, baby boys, that they are able to set the foundation as soon as they come out of the womb? How do you get to these situations?
I think one of the best ways to start getting people to change their mindset at a younger age is for the fathers or the men that step in as fathers, because sometimes the fathers are not there, but if they step in as fathers, to spend time with the kids. I think that's the best thing you can do, is just spend time with them and carry conversations with them so they can have trust in you. It's all kinds of ways to spend time. I grab my grandkids and I take them fishing. We get a boat, something that they have not done. We just get on a boat and we fish, have fun, laugh, talk. And when you're doing that, you're building a stronger relationship with your children, because you're not just seeing them in the house for a minute. How you doing? You say, how was your day? Then you send them off on their own, or they just go in the room and they're on playing PlayStation all the time. Now, I have my grandbabies, they love to do that. Davon, they have a brother named DJ and a cousin named Jarrell, and they're in different houses, and they play the games at night when they're in the house, and that's great. But it's at times I have to pull them together and say, let's go fishing, let's take a walk, let's go to the zoo, just so they can start to realize if they have any issue, that they can come to you and talk to you, because you already started building that up. You know, and the young people don't realize that's what you're building up, a strong relationship with them. But when they get in the situation and they got something to think about, they're going to come to you because of the trust. And I think that's what we have to do, and start taking the kids out and teaching them how to give back to the community. And that's what Davon's mother was doing, actually. I mean, when she would go out and feed the community, which she was doing that night, she had Davon with her feeding the community. So he's starting to learn how to give back to the community. And I think that's very strong to talk to your kids and teach them how to give back.
You know, I think right before we came on, Keisha Lance Bottoms from Atlanta was on CNN, and she said that when she was, I believe, a magistrate judge, she said that when she saw all of these young black men coming into her courtroom, she said that the lion's share of them did not have high school degrees. And one of the things that she said that may have been part of the answer, again, is education. She said without even the minimal education, if you cannot read, if you cannot write, you don't have the ability to be a skilled person. And it was fascinating just to listen to her just an hour ago, and it seems that this is where we are right now. as part of one of the issues having to do with violence in our community. Just, you know, a final thought there before we wrap up again, just something to think about: funding those support groups and continuing to fund education in our community, and hopefully being able to change those hearts and minds to keep those communities as safe as we possibly can. John Ayala, again, our condolences to you and your family, and I thank you so much for your strength and showing up on this program the way that you have, and also Dr. Bahia Muhammad. It is always, always, always a pleasure to have you on this program. We really, really appreciate you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is The Daily Drum for this Wednesday, July 8th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.